you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
We need to roll back the state. We spy on all of our own citizens.
Our prisons are flooded with nonviolent drug offenders.
If you want to know who America's next enemy is, look at who we're funding right now. Every single one of these problems are a result of government being way too big. What's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. I'm your host, Dave Smith, and very happy to have returning favorite guest of ours, the great Michael Heiss. Of course, you guys know Michael Heiss is the founder and the head of the Mises Caucus and led the takeover of the Libertarian Party this last year in May. It's March already of the next year, and we wanted to have Michael on to kind of talk about how things are going and what's next for the Mises Caucus and for the Libertarian Party. So, Mike, how are you, brother?
I'm doing good, man. I'm busier than I've ever been.
Well, that's good.
It doesn't end with the takeover, that's for sure.
Yeah, it turns out that was just the beginning, which of course was the plan all along. I guess even before we kind of get into the next phase, how have you felt just kind of reflecting on what happened over the last few years? I mean, I was following you from the very beginning of this journey, and joined you fairly early into it. But it was kind of a somewhat daunting thing that you set out to do. I remember I was looking back just recently at the initial Facebook post that you made that was like now it's been shared a few times, so it has like some interaction with it. But this started with you just like posting on Facebook like, hey, you know what? Wouldn't it be cool if there was like a Mises caucus that like actually really pushed Austrian economics and non-intervention, and there were some of the Ron Paul people were in the Libertarian Party, and it's, you know, it gets like 13 likes or something like that. And then just a few years later, you're like, yeah, you did it. You went and took this whole thing, this over, and, you know, like kind of galvanized this whole movement. What do you think when you reflect on that?
Honestly, I try not to. The kind of the mindset that I take is we're storming Normandy and you know, there's not really time for stopping. So, I mean, obviously I'm happy about it. I feel a lot more responsibility now. Like, you know, I feel, you know, there's a lot, my sense of responsibility is really heightened, and, you know, we have to deliver now. We have to kind of take that next step. So I'm really happy that the messaging has taken the turn that it has. I'm really happy that we're representing our principles and doing all those things that we set out to do. But there's a lot more to do, and that's going to be the hard part stepping forward. So, you know, happy and elated. You know, there was a lot of personal things built up into that, a lot of beef, a lot of hatred that was aimed at us. So I'm relieved that, you know, people of such low character don't have their hands on the levers anymore. But I'm concerning myself with kind of just taking that pivot from taking the party to doing something with it. And you know, that's going to take some time. But I think we got some good plans, and I think we've rolled out some really great stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to get into that in just a second. I will say, as people who listen to the show know, I'm a big believer in the importance of like inserting our ideas into the public consciousness. I know you are too. And so like there always was like, that to me, like people downplay that sometimes, but I think it's really important, and I think it's kind of hard to even measure exactly how important it is to have this Libertarian Party, if we want our libertarian ideas out there in the wider conversation, to actually be standing for them. The Libertarian Party, you know, I remember before our people were running the show there, you know, back in the day, or they're the, you know, like everyone knows, like the anti-racism tweets from Joe Jorgensen and stuff like that. But I remember tweets about how, like, you know, they were like, well, while we're against mandates, you really should wear your mask and socially distance and probably shouldn't go into work anyway. Like, that was as far as they would go.
How I describe it is they were trying to take a libertarian principle and insert that while upholding the narrative that was overriding our rights in the first place.
Right.
And the narrative is what people bite down on first. So there's not, like, basically we just made ourselves safe to the mainstream narrative that's already, like, overriding all of our rights, so we could be safely dismissed and embarrassing ourselves.
Right. And it's kind of like, even if, like, okay, you could theoretically, I'm not saying you couldn't, but you could theoretically hold libertarian principles and still kind of believe in the overarching, like, narrative. Like, you could believe, like, well, the best thing to do really is for nobody to go to work and for us to be in lockdown, but I'm still against the government forcing it because technically I don't believe in that. But of course, once you accept that, it makes it, like, impossible to sell your message, because then to everyone else they go, wait, so you're just saying, like, everyone's going to die if we go to work, but you also want to make it legal to go to work? Like, no, then I'll just go with the government policy, or, like, you know. And so it's so much more compelling and accurate when you're like, oh no, this is all a big scam. None of this is real. Like, there's no need to lock down. And also, we believe in liberty. So anyway, the Libertarian Party tweeted out today, about an hour ago, and I just retweeted it. It's moments like this that really just make me happy that we got people, you know, of character and principle running the thing. They said today, because, by the way, if you don't know, today is the 3-year anniversary of the first of the longest 15 days in human history. Today's the 3-year anniversary of 15 days to slow the spread. And they said, today is the third anniversary of 15 days to slow the spread. As we all know, politicians turned it into 15 months to flatten the world. No lockdowns or vaccine mandates for any reason ever again. Quote, national emergencies are always excuses to violate your rights. And it's just like, look, if there's to be a Libertarian Strong Party, problem. That's what they should be set. That's exactly right. Like, that's exactly right. I don't know who wrote it. Probably Dave, if I had to guess. But that's just like, that correct. That's what you're supposed to be saying if you're the Libertarian Party. If you're not, then why are we even doing this? You know, so it's just nice to hear.
Right. And finally crafting a narrative. That's what you were saying. Like, they were adopting the narrative of the regime before and trying to put libertarian principles in there and then wondering why there was no response to it. Where if you're brave and you get the narrative right at the beginning, or at least have the courage to question it, that's what people remember. And then that's the thing that builds your credibility in the long term. Not that, oh, he's believed in property rights for 40 years. You know, it's the willing to be brave and put your own reputation on the line and buck the system consistently. And this is the importance of what you're getting at about, like, putting the information out there and putting the principles out there, is that we as libertarians, we talk about the power of the state a lot. And that really is, you know, the core of the problem. But I would say the primary means of control that are used against us are psychological. And that's why it's the media. That's why it's education. And that's the first layer. That's the velvet glove that sits over the iron fist that is the state. And that's the primary method of control, and therefore the primary thing that we have to disentangle in order to, like, compel people towards our side in the first place.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more. And that's why they are so invested in their propaganda campaigns. And that's why, because they recognize how important that is.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So we've got a lot of cool stuff coming up. I want to get into all of this. I want to get into it. You've got this, the Decentralized Revolution, plan of action. There's this tour coming up. I'm very excited to be a part of that. I'll be, in the April event, on April 1st here in, New York. I say here, I'm not in New York City, but close by in, New York City. So I want to get into this whole tour that you're doing, but first let's start with this, what do I call it? Kind of a, I don't want to say a memo. It was kind of like this manifesto.
We're calling it our strategic manifesto. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a good way to put it. But don't worry, it's not like no one shot up a school or anything like that. The term manifesto has really been degraded over the years by mass shooters, but there's some good ones out there. But so tell me a little bit about this. But you put this out a few months back, and it kind of really, like, it was like, look, this is the call to action. This is the next step for the Mises Caucus.
Yeah, man. So we have launched what we're calling Project Decentralized Revolution. And that's basically the call to action itself. And that Project Decentralized Revolution comprises of a couple of programs. And one of them we're calling our Run as Libertarian program, which is mostly what is outlined in that strategic manifesto. But the idea is that the manifesto starts out with kind of like some vinegar for us as libertarians, particularly LP members, and basically calling for us to get real with ourselves and to get honest with ourselves, get honest about where we are as a third party, where third parties are within the reality, like within political reality, and therefore setting the table on what's feasible in the short term, medium term, long term, and therefore picking the highest value propositions for us to move forward with so that we can be most effective. Because if we don't have that honesty, we're not going to be able to calculate. If we can't calculate, we're not going to be able to act right. You know, so it's taking praxeology to political activity, you know, like, yeah. Basically. And ultimately what we came up with is kind of just really crystallizing and putting the details into what we've been saying the whole time when it comes to, we need to focus locally. So what Project Decentralized Revolution outlines is a year over year strategy for the Libertarian Party that is realistic, scalable, and gives us more political power than we ever have if we were to follow it. Now, one of those pieces of vinegar, that shots of vinegar, is there's no silver bullets. There's no quick fixes. This is going to be a long-term battle. This is going to be a long-term solution. I don't think there is any period, regardless of whether it's LP, agorism, GOP, whatever it is. I don't think there's any quick fixes. The progressives took 100 years to get it where it is now. And, you know, so we're going to have to live our lives for this. And that's just the reality of it, if we're serious about it. So essentially where the strategy.
Let me just stop you there even before you get into the strategy, because it's interesting to kind of like take each one of these pieces apart. And I do think you're right. This is true in general for dissidents of the current regime, like not even just libertarians. You could be like some, you know, a left winger who's like actually for left wing policies, like is actually, you know, like a good anti-war kind of, you know, like anti-corruption left winger. Or you could be like a right wing dissident who's completely against the regime. It's everybody, even though they know how bad it is, there's a natural tendency to try to live in this fantasy world where there will be some quick fix for this, where there will be, right. Okay, this just,
it's appealing.
Something happens.
It's psychologically pleasing. Yeah.
Yes, it's the end of the movie. The end of the movie is supposed to be you're right up against it, and then the thing happens, and then, you know, from the jaws of defeat, you pull victory, and there you go. Okay, and even just trying to be realistic about this stuff often shatters people's kind of like illusions. But if you want to actually be successful, I think it's the way to do it. I remember, so I'm thinking back to, I had a debate with a former chair who shall not be named, as he's been banished.
Disgraced former chair.
Yes, he's been banished into the dustbin of history. But I had this debate with him at the Soho Forum, which I'm sure a lot of you guys have watched. And the whole debate, one of the things that like really like stuck with me is like this whole debate, I'm there, I'm just, you know, I'm me, and he's trying to be suit and tie moderate. So I'm like, I hate all these people, the state's evil, like we have this compelling message, my God, look at what's going on, the country's on a suicide mission, you know, and he's like, well, we have to listen to everybody, we can't go this crazy or then we'll turn people off. And then at one point he says what has been the Libertarian Party tagline, he goes, our goal is nothing less than to set the world free in our lifetimes. And you're just like, oh, okay.
Hyper-revolutionary, yeah.
Yes, you're talking about not, like, this is literally what you're stating. After I'm the radical one and you're here being Mr. Pragmatic, your goal is not only to have a revolution of freedom in America, Canada, Mexico, all of Latin America, all of South America. We're going to spread it through Africa. We're going to dip back up, go take over all of Europe and set everybody free. And then we get to Asia. And by the time when we start getting to Asia, I'm probably around 60, 65 years old, because I still got another 20 years, because this is within my lifetime, where I'm going to set the entire world free. And that sounds really nice. It sounds really nice to say we're going to set the world free in our lifetime. The probability of this ever happening is 0.0%. Like there's absolutely no chance.
It's also self-aggrandizing. Yeah. You're the hero of the world.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and that's, we got to bring that down a little bit. I mean, like our principles are heroic, but yeah.
Like, look, if someone were to say to you, I'm not even letting, if they go, you know, if they said, If someone goes, we will have constitutional carry in all 50 states within our lifetime, you'd be like, that's a daunting check call. You know what I mean? Like, that's a lot to try to get just like one area of free, you know? And so there's just, we do, it's interesting. There's something that's kind of like counterintuitive, that even though we're the far more radical purist libertarians, we're also the ones who are going like, okay, no, look, we have to have, we can be in our rhetoric as pure and hardcore as we should be, but then also in our goals, we have to be really pragmatic and target achievable victories.
And we have to be deliberate and defined, because when you have something like that, like liberty in our lifetime, it kind of puts, well, what's the next step in out into the fog? You know what I mean? And you again, it screws up your calculation. Okay, so we're here right now. We have this ideal of quote unquote liberty in our lifetime. So then what's the next step? It's so daunting that you can't calculate. And again, if you can't calculate, you can't move. So yeah. Like you can't, and so you have to kind of bring things back down to reality in order to be able to take that next step. And it's yes. Just, it's the kind of the classic cliche or saying or whatever of like, you know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, you know,
yes,
you kind
yes.
of, yeah.
And there's something to, and it's a challenge for members of the Libertarian Party. And I, not even just like the, I mean, the ones in our camp, you know, who far outnumber the ones outside of our camp. And I know, look, I got some people within the Mises Caucus gave me pushback when I supported Blake Masters out in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And like, look, fair enough. There was, as I always said, there was an argument to it. There is an argument to like why some people thought this was the wrong move. I've given my argument on why I thought it was the right move before. We don't have to go back over that. But I remember this one thing that kind of stuck with me was there were several people who go, they go, well, if the Libertarian Party candidate is just going to get concessions from the you know, a Republican candidate and then drop out of the race, I mean, that's an insult to everybody who volunteered and donated his money, because he just wasted all those resources. And I was just, now forget how you feel about whether I should have supported Blake Masters or not. All that aside, I'm just saying this mentality that your resources are wasted if you dropped out and got concessions. But if you finish the race and get 5%, then what? The resources like now, it's purely like emotional and in your head. And
yes.
There's just a certain psychology to this that we kind of have to break out of, where you go like, no, look, what we're targeting are real victories, not pretending that money wasn't wasted because we ran somewhere.
Right. And especially the caveat that I'll give to that is there wasn't ballot access considerations in that race. And I think that calculus would flip if there were. But yeah, there was not ballot access considerations in that race. So I agree with you. And I think what you're touching on there is that part of what fuels politics, especially today, is you have your in-group and your tribe, and you have your out-group and your enemy, and you are united against them. Even if things are not necessarily totally internally cohesive or united, you know, you have to preserve the in-group no matter what. And I think that is a tendency in all sectors of politics, even libertarians. And, you know, so I think people are still have that tendency. And again, that's something that I'm calling to break out of, that we can't be partisans. We don't have the luxury to be blind partisans, because if our call to people outside of our own groups is going to be, okay, join the Libertarian Party, but only if you're going to 100% vote with only us every time, that's it, you're a libertarian, everybody else has got to go, everything else has got to go, when we don't really have much to offer in terms of helping these different in-groups destroy their enemy or threaten them to be destroyed themselves, then, you know, that's not really a good pitch. We're going to have to be a little bit more accommodating to kind of earn their trust. And the word trust is prevalent in that document. That's another thing that we don't talk about a lot. We talk about our ideas, we talk about our principles, and that is the end goal, is to get people to buy into those things. But we don't really talk about psychology, and we don't talk about how to get people to bite down on those things. And so for me, it's how do we generate trust, wider trust in society? And you know, I think our plan does that.
All right, guys, let's take a moment and thank our sponsor for today's show. One of my favorite sponsors we've ever had here. You know him, SheathUnderwear.com, the underwear of legends, the only underwear that I ever own, the best pair of boxer briefs I've ever put on my body. I threw out everything else, and all I wear is Sheath. Anytime you see me, anytime you hear my voice, I am speaking to you, coming to you in a comfortable pair of Sheath underwear. They're just the best. You put them on, they're just super high quality. They feel comfortable. They have the dual pouches that separate your man parts. It's a game changer. And you don't have to use it. You could just wear them like regular underwear, but you're going to want to check out that dual pouch. I'm telling you. They also have gator necks and hoodies and t-shirts, a bunch of just really quality stuff. Go check them out over at sheathunderwear.com. And of course, they're a loyal sponsor of us. They've been with us for over 3 years. So they're the best underwear you're ever going to own. And they're a really loyal sponsor of Part of the Problem. So please do go check them out. Sheathunderwear.com. Use the promo code PROBLEM20, and that will get you 20% off your entire order. Sheathunderwear.com. Promo code PROBLEM20 for 20% off. All right, let's get back into the show. So let's get into the plan. So what is it?
So, okay. So we've been talking a long time now about we have to run local. And that is true. But again, even that's kind of vague and out in the ether. So we have to really drill down and say, what exactly are we doing? Okay. We have to run for city council, mayor and school board, sheriff and judge. Now, sheriff and judge is county level races. Even that is a little out of our pay grade. We should seek it. But really, that mayor, school board and city council should be the primary thing that we are running for. That's what the most amount of our effort should be going for. And then even then, you might say, well, you know, Philadelphia, you need to raise about $1 million or more to win. And so even the big cities, this is rough. We need to be running for these races in as many places as possible where it's as realistic as possible. So then what exactly do I mean by as realistic as possible? We can use data to generate that answer. So like in my state of Pennsylvania, for example, we have an awesome guy here named BJ who has done the work to basically look at all the municipal level elections that happened in the last election. And he found that there was literally dozens of city council, mayor and school board seats that the entire race had 50 votes or less in them. I don't mean the winner got 50 votes. I mean the entire race had 50 votes or less in them, and sometimes 10 or less. So you can create now from a state party perspective, you can get that data and say, okay, we are now going to run a campaign to recruit people for these positions. We want you to run for city council no matter what, but these ultimate low-hanging fruit positions that are of consequence with 50 votes or less, are depending on what the bottom rung, maybe your state it's 100 votes or less, but you get my point. Really target those races. So now you have the beginning of an actual political strategy, because if you were to go into the state parties by and large right now, the culture in terms of politics is, well, just run for something, man. We're just trying to get on the ballot, man. And there's just no direction. There's no aim. And again, if there's no aim, you can't calculate. If you can't calculate, you can't act. So it's really about bringing praxeology into this. So the state parties, because and again, people try to gloss this up in the state parties. We're like, well, I wouldn't want to tell somebody what to do. And it's like, well, then what the hell does leadership mean?
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? Like leadership is.
By the way, I hate this. There's something. By the way, this is the thing that drives me the craziest about libertarians. It's just like, and I love libertarians and I love libertarianism as much as any person on this planet. But that whole, like, there's a strand in libertarianism where they go, well, I'm not going to like tell someone what to do. And I'm like, are you putting a gun to their head and forcing them to do it? Because if not, it's consistent with libertarianism. Like, as someone said that to me the other day, I was on Twitter, was arguing with some I was like, he was like, libertarians believe this, and I was like, no, libertarians believe this, you don't speak for us. And he's like, I'm as qualified to speak for libertarians as you are. And I was like, no, actually you're not, because I speak for way more of them than you do, you know, guy with a couple thousand followers. I speak for way more libertarians than you, so I'm much more qualified to speak for them. And then someone goes, anyone who needs someone else to speak for them isn't a libertarian. And you're like,
yeah,
what?
Perfect like, example.
What does that mean? I can't have a lawyer in a court because I'm a libertarian? Like, what? I could have someone else speak for me.
If I pay to be a member at a boxing gym, yes. I am literally paying somebody who maybe they're a retired fighter or maybe they were an amateur fighter. I am paying somebody to tell me what to do because I respect their leadership. I respect their experience, and I want to learn and I want to better myself. That's what leadership is. People conflate sometimes libertarians because, and this is another thing, libertarians have every bit of capacity to be ideologically possessed as anybody else. And I think that's like what you're getting at.
Yeah.
And
getting the ideology wrong, even. It's not even like directly ideologically possessed, but yeah.
And, you know, there's a difference between leadership, which is a social phenomenon that is hardwired into us to recognize hierarchy, and tyranny. Of course, nobody wants tyranny and wants to be told by a strong man what to do. But part of like hierarchy, social hierarchy, part of life is you look up to and admire people who have achieved things that are admirable to you and aim to be like them, and then take measures to learn how to better yourself and orient yourself in that direction. And that is what a leader is in the organic social sense. So if you are a leadership of the party, you should be providing avenues to maximize the activity of the people who are underneath you volunteering. Yeah, and 100%. That isn't there right now. And if you don't even have a political strategy, then you don't have a fundraising strategy. If you don't have a political strategy or a fundraising strategy, you don't have a recruitment strategy. The recruitment strategy is, well, we really fucking like property rights. That's the recruitment strategy. That's not enough. That's not compelling enough.
Yeah, no, certainly not on a level that's scalable to like really get a lot of people into this. I also think that there's been state parties before, and actually you kind of like schooled me to this a little bit, where I remember in the old guard in Pennsylvania, where they kind of had this strategy of like find mm-hmm. uncontested races, throw candidates at those races, and then say, look, we won a race. And a lot of
I was one of them. I won.
Yeah, right. It's a lot of these positions were like, you know, the dog catcher is the kind of like go-to joke on them. But
it was constable, which there are states where constable matters. Pennsylvania is not one of them.
Right.
It was constable and elections inspector. And I resigned because it's useless. Right. It's useless. And they spent tens of thousands of dollars to send physical mailers to get people into these positions so that they could pad their numbers and say, we have the highest number of elected libertarians.
So
and then if you... Yeah.
You realize that it's just like, oh, wait, no. Okay, there's some more detail to this. If you're spending $30,000 to get people elected to, or $60,000 to get people elected to positions that don't matter, that don't have any impact, and then you can sit there and literally the result you have is that you have a talking point that you can brag about and say, we have the most elected libertarians in this state. You're like, okay, but if this isn't translating into any victory for liberty, what is that? Contrast that.
You're racist.
Right.
Yeah.
Contrast that to having two sheriffs in a state. You know, you got two. There were a few sheriffs, I don't believe enough. Members of the Libertarian Party, but there were a few sheriffs around this country who were real heroes in 2020. I highlighted a few of them on this show who straight up said, we will not enforce lockdowns. We will not enforce mask mandates. We will not enforce, you know, the whatever, people being deemed non-essential. These were heroes who protected real people's real liberty in real life. You get a couple of those in your state, you've done more than having every single election inspector.
The same thing happened in Illinois, I want to say a month or two ago. They were putting forward some hardcore gun control measures, and like the majority of the sheriffs across the state were like, no, yeah. Nope. And if you're one of those people who live in that state, and again, with your COVID example, you're pretty friggin' grateful that you have a sheriff with some balls.
And now look, and now if that sheriff wants to run for something bigger, or even if the Libertarian Party just wants to, like, I understand we want talking points to brag about, but instead of the talking point of the old Pennsylvania guard being like, haha, we have the highest number with no result from that. Now you're going,
most liberty.
We protected you and we will protect you again. And that's always going to be, by the way, at least when it comes to politics, the only way I've ever seen it successfully done is by convincing people you're going to protect them. That's like what every single politician attempts to do, is to convince people that there's this external threat to them and we're going to protect you. And it is true. We're just the ones who recognize that the external threat are the politicians.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you start off with this bottom rung of people to these local level positions with teeth. And the teeth comes from the 10th Amendment. Like, again, our whole thing is about nullification and decentralization. So the 10th Amendment, you can do whatever you is passable by the locality in there. And so you start there. And then again, so now you have a political strategy. The state party can then start going to donors and members and saying, hey, we actually have a political strategy. So if we raise X amount of dollars, we can get this software and that tool and this to maximize this political strategy. So now you have a combined political strategy and fundraising strategy, which then comes together to inform your recruitment strategy. Hey, everybody, we've got tools to make your job available. We want you in. Hey, you're a member of the party, or you're registered libertarian and you're in this area. Well, hey, one of those seats with 50 votes or less is in your town. We need you involved. We got tools. We can help you. We can actually help you, which doesn't happen. Right. State parties don't really haven't been too helpful for a lot of campaigns. And, you know, so that all of that comes together to actually cover all of these bases. So then we're orienting. So then the question is for the Libertarian Party, what is the highest value propositions? I would argue that it's one, these local level races of high impact, and then B, ballot access, or two, ballot access. So then you might ask the question, well, you don't have local level elections every year. So what do you do? And we've got a strategy for that, that again, maximizes the effect of and the aim at local level races while trying to also maximize for ballot access. So in most states, in the years that you don't have local level races, you're going to have your Senate races and your state house races, or and every 4 years, your governor's races. So what you can do is, what we advocate in that document is that you run for state house. Now, if we have to level with people, you're not going to win state house. Like it's happened. It's rare. They don't win re-election. You're not going to win. Most likely you're not going to win. However, that does not mean that there's not a goal for it, because if you run for state house, the district that you're running in must necessarily comprise of the locality that you would otherwise be running in if you ran local. So take your state house race, aim the entire thing in your locality. Knock every door that you can in your locality. Make friends with local level elites, church leaders, you know, community leaders. Get on a committee. Do all of the work to make yourself a known quantity, because generally speaking, you're not going to be getting elected to anything if you just come out of the ether. You have to be a known quantity in your community. So like that's a big component of it too. But if we level with people and say, listen, your goal here, you're ostensibly running for state house, but really you're building up to your local level race that's realistic. You know, that so that makes it much easier for them to win. But this also then gives your Senate candidate who's shooting for ballot access, or your governor candidate, a framework by which to campaign. They can then say, oh, there's all these state house races that need support. I will go and help them collect signatures around the state. They get signatures for me. And then this minimizes the amount of money that you have to spend, because most of the times the parties have to spend money just to get on the ballot, and then they're spent by the time they ever get to the general. We did this in Pennsylvania. We had an all-time high number of state house races. They got signatures for themselves and the governor at the same time, and we got on the ballot for free in the first time in our history. And then they went on to maintain minor party status here in Pennsylvania for the first time ever in a midterm election. So you focus locally, you maximize for trying to get ballot access, and the state house races become farming systems for the local level races.
Okay. And then, I just completely agree with all of that. I think this was always like the broad strokes ideas that we had talked about, but I really like you guys kind of like how you kind of flushed it all out here. Like, this is the path forward for the Libertarian Party. And then in terms of like statewide and national, like, races, what do you think, like which you talk about in the paper, I'm just setting you up to say this, but so what do you think, like, what's the goal of someone who's running for Senate, or someone who's running for president or anything like that?
It's still ballot access, but beyond that, because you're not guaranteed to get it, you know, so beyond that, it should be a state level version of what the national messaging is. It should be to shift the Overton window for the state, drive recruitment for the state, and paint a narrative and a picture of who and what we as libertarians are, so that people have an accurate picture to bite down on, and then we can pull them in. And then that funnels down into, cause people burn out, man. This is all volunteer work. You know, it's hard. And so like, if you don't have something realistic, people are just going to eventually throw their hands up and say, what the fuck am I doing here? I have kids, you know, like, or whatever. And so you have to get out of that trap. So if we get them excited about the ideas, funnel them in, and then give them some realistic work that actually has some viability to it, now you start to win. And if you can kind of create a culture of winning and an attitude of winning, it starts to become a self-perpetuating cycle. And then finally, you might ask, well, what about where you got counties and stuff like that that don't have enough people and they don't run candidates? Like, we're still the Libertarian Party. We're still not filling up the ballot. We're still small. So this is where the role of issue coalitions comes in. You know, if you don't have candidates, then maybe you should be lobbying your city council if you're a blue town for like a ban on the warrantless use of surveillance technology, or maybe your red town, you should be lobbying for gun sanctuaries to, again, build that trust. There are a lot of rank and file, honest to God, conservatives who are a lot more serious about their Second Amendment rights than the politicians that they've elected.
Yep.
So we can come in and exploit that gap and deliver that for them and start to gain that trust. Because I don't even think we can have, when you think about this friend enemy distinction, in group out group distinction, I don't think it's really unless you're talking to somebody who is at like the very high end of trait openness distribution. I don't think it's possible to really even have the meaningful conversations until we start to build the trust, because we're asking them to leave their in-group or risk leaving their in-group and risk the social ostracization that comes with that. And that's a lot to ask of somebody. That's why we can't be like, we have to be a partisan or nothing at all. You know, we're asking a lot of people by leaving their in-groups.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's also, and then the other thing about that, and this was also often a criticism of the Ron Paul presidential campaigns, which I think is somewhat fair, was that there was, and this is what's cool, like really cool about what the Libertarian Party has to offer, especially now that the Mises Caucus people are in there and actually trying to, like, you know, present a vision for what it could be, rather than this just kind of, which literally what it used to be, it was just run for something and vote chase, get as many votes as you can, and we set the world free in our lifetime. That's yep. That's the plan. You know, it's like, but now what you're talking about is like, yeah, what you want to have is like, you want to have these great candidates. Like, you know, you have people like Shane Hazel or something like that, who's running for Senate. You want to have presidential candidates who can inspire people, like a la Ron Paul. But the criticism of the Ron Paul movement was that, okay, so now you got all these kids. Okay, so now what? And right. Ron Paul, to his credit and in some ways to his detriment, was always, you know, you do whatever you think, you know, whatever you think you should do, you go do. And like, okay, a lot of us, so like we're here now, you know, like a lot of us are, mm-hmm. This is what we're doing now. But now this is much more of a thing of like, what are you going to do? Okay, where do you live? What locality are you in? Okay, here's what I need you to do. And a lot of times it's not that big of an ask. Here's what I need you to do. Go vote for this guy for sheriff. Go put this guy on your school board. Not even saying run for something, saying, hey, get active in your local community and just show up once every couple of years and support our guys. And then the ones who are a little bit more willing to get into it, hey, I want you to go run for this. And now there's a plan of action where we can actually start putting real pressure toward this massive decentralist, this radical decentralized movement where people, like, a real difference can be made. Because like we all know, even if Ron Paul today was appointed president of the United States, very little would change other than the consciousness. You know what I mean? Other than the fact that he could speak on such a huge platform, and that could change a lot. But politically, the levers of power are locked in, and they're not even really in the executive branch. You know what I mean? Or they're right. They're not in the Oval Office, let's say.
And people, the executive branch. If there's one thing that I've been pleased to see with the COVID regime bullshit is that people are rediscovering in mass the primacy of local level politics.
Yes.
You know, you saw all these moms flooding school board meetings because of the mask mandates or the school shutdowns. And now you're seeing it maintained, you know, through like the CRT stuff in the curriculums and the child sexual like propaganda and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I think it's a damn shame that it took, you know, child sexual stuff for people to realize that they're being propagandized by the government. It had to go that far to the extreme before people said, like, well, wait a minute, what about the history? You know, and you know, like, and right. You know, all of that kind of stuff. But hey, we have an opening now, and it's massive, and we can exploit that, and we have to exploit that. And again, what everything I've just described, this is one half. This is the political part. This is the run is libertarian. And to comment on what Ron Paul always said, to his credit, again, I'm trying to bring a realistic thing to the Libertarian Party. I know we're not winning Congress. I know we're not winning Senate. And I'm not trying to fool you anymore. Like, I'm not trying to tell you that we are. What we now have today with a liberty movement that did not exist, you know, prior to the Ron Paul explosion is we have a much more of a choose your own adventure type of thing. And yeah. This is why leaders in the liberty movement shouldn't be at each other's throats. You know, maybe you're more focused on Congress, and maybe that's what you truly, honest to God, believe should be the focus. You know what? Go to the Republican Liberty Caucus. You know, maybe you truly believe that state house is the best thing. Okay, check out y'all. We've got that network. Maybe you want to learn homesteading and you want to become more self-sufficient, and maybe you think that's what it is, and fuck politics and blah, blah, blah. Check out Freedom Cells. You know, but we've got we've got all the bases covered and we just need to coordinate with each other and support each other.
No, you know what I mean? And there's a bunch, it's like moving to the Free State Project, homeschooling your kids. We've got the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum. Like there's all these different like avenues, but this is a really important one too. I really agree with you about that. And that's why, and I think that some of the, I'd say some of the people, like the more mature ones and stuff are like kind of coming around to that idea that you're like, oh, this isn't like a competition between Tho Bishop and Michael Heiss and like the Free State Project. You know what I'm saying? Like that's stupid. Yeah. Like this isn't a competition. We're all aiming at the same thing from different angles. And you know what I mean? We're going to see whatever. There's a lot of these goals can go hand in hand. Okay. Let's talk about this tour. What's this all about?
So the tour is our big push for the other half of Project Decentralized Revolution, which is culture. We're not dumb to that. We're not claiming that politics is the end all be all of what has to be done here. A big part of what we're trying to do is get involved in the culture, whether that be, you know, expanding our relationships with people with platforms beyond just our regular libertarian circles. You know, you've done a great job of that with Joe Rogan and Tim Pool. We're talking with Anomaly. We've recruited Iraq veteran 8888 into the party. You know, these are all part of that kind of cultural thing of like, who is out there that's interested or at least skeptical that we can get interested and start talking to and building trust with so that they can start affecting their networks. The other part of it though, is that I am thoroughly convinced that regardless of what the strategy is, whether it's LP, whether it's GOP, whether it's agorism, whatever have you, all of them are destined to fail if we do not have a robust community that gives a shit about each other. And we have to foster that while at the same time doing the work. So the tour is really, you know, it's 2023. It's the year before the presidential cycle. We're this is the most boring and least engaging part of the presidential cycle. So what we want to do is we want to, you know, keep our community engaged. We want to keep our people engaged and bring them together to have a good time together. And offer that opportunity to get training while also bringing out, you know, the biggest voices in the liberty movement to help keep them motivated and teaching us. So the Take Human Action Tour is starting. It's a 6-city tour of speaking events with training opportunities attached to them that are running through April and May. And we're hitting New York on April 1st. We're hitting Chicago on April 15th. We're hitting Nashville, Tennessee on the 27th of April. We're hitting Austin, Texas on the 29th. And then we're hitting Oakland, California. I forget the date on that one, on May 13th. And then we're hitting Denver, Colorado on May 27th. And, you know, we're bringing out, I mean, the entire, like almost everybody you can think about, and no two events are the same. You know, we've got you and Maj and Tom coming to New York. Jeff Deist is going to be at the Nashville event. There's also going to be a debate between Clint Russell and Destiny at that one. We've got Michael Rechtenwald coming out to Chicago and a couple of other ones. You know, we got Ryan McMacken coming to the Denver one. I've never seen McMacken at anything related, even closely related to the LP. I'm really excited about that. You know, we've got Ian Crossland going out to the Oakland, California one. So again, we're kind of spreading out. And the idea here is that not only is this a tour, and obviously we're promoting it, and I'm promoting and trying to get people out, but I've used this as an opportunity to go out to say Young Americans for Liberty and say, hey man, come table this event for free, just promote it. Hey Fee, come table this event and just promote it. And let's get a cross section of the Liberty movement at these things. And you know what? You've got just as much an opportunity to get somebody from my audience and vice versa. And let's just all grow with each other and let's build this community, because again, the community is going to be the thing that keeps us together as the times get increasingly dark, as the economy goes, it gets increasingly dark. You know, it's going to be the thing that keeps us together and keeps us going is that community, that remnant that we're all trying to bring back together.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm really looking forward to this tour. I'm really looking forward to the New York event. And I don't think you and Tom and Maj probably haven't all hung out together since
and
Gene's gonna be there.
Gene will be there. Yeah,
can't wait. I really can't wait for that. Gene wasn't even at Reno. This is even more than we had there. All right, guys, let's take a moment and thank our sponsor for today's show, which is Freeze Pipe. Smoking cannabis doesn't have to hurt. Did you know that smoking cannabis hurts up to 2.5 million people? I'm just making numbers up, but Freeze Pipe, go check it out. Luis J. Gomez, my pothead friend, swears by this, and he's a very experienced smoker. The smoother clouds without the throat burn, chest pain, no coughing attacks. Freeze Pipe makes a unique line of freezable pipes, bubblers, bongs, and dab rigs that cool smoke by over 300 degrees. The smoke is so smooth, you'll check to see if the bowl is even lit. The secret is freezable glycerin chambers that come on every piece. Pop one of these chambers in the freezer for 1 hour, and as smoke passes through, it's instantly chilled for a dramatically smoother and icy experience. Think larger clouds with zero chest and throat burn. Finally, no more coughing attacks and no more water chugging after every rip. Just an elegant smoking experience that'll change how you light up forever. All right, start smoking like royalty right now without paying a king's ransom. Shop now and enjoy free shipping at freezepipe.com. And if you use the promo code POTP, you'll get 10% off your entire order. That's freezepipe.com, promo code POTP for 10% off your order. Order today and say goodbye to harsh smoke forever. All right, let's get back into the show. Okay, and then by the way, because you just said a few times that there's this training attached to it. So like, if you could just specify on that a little bit more, like what training
so,
is going to be about.
So it's candidate training. So now everyone needs to go to takehumanactiontour.com. And that's where the tickets for all the different events and all the details of all the different events are, takehumanactiontour.com. But you've got the speaking events on Saturday with a hangout and meetup afterward. And then we have candidate trainings that are completely free to attend the day after. So like in New York, Larry Sharp is going to be running a campaign training. The Grassroots Leadership Academy is going to be hosting trainings at a couple of these other ones. But then like we've got Kelly Cardin, who is an elected libertarian county commissioner out in California. Aaron Lamb is going to be doing training in Denver. He beat a long-term incumbent for mayor in Keensburg, Colorado. So these are people who have already done the work, who have created their own training modules. So again, we're bringing the community together. We're trying to have a good time. We're trying to run education and then also train and be serious about the work.
Yeah, no, this is just absolutely great. And it really is, like, to me, this is it. It's really a breath of fresh air compared to like the previous, like LP regime. And it's interesting to see, kind of like the change. Like I said before, it's like this is kind of like what we always talked about when we would say what, like there was kind of this before the Mises Caucus came into the existence, before you manifested that, there were two major caucuses in the Libertarian Party. I mean, there were always like several, but the two big ones were the pragmatists and the radicals. And the pragmatists don't exist anymore, but they, you know, just got stomped into oblivion, and the radicals are still there, I think, or whatever. But there was something kind of funny, and not saying that every member of these caucus like fell into this trap, but there's something about like the distinction between like it's like, well, do we want to be pragmatic or do we want to be radical? And what we would always say is like we need like radical pragmatism, like that, or pragmatic radicalism. Like that's what the Libertarian Party really needs to be. There is like, there's this one, because you can always see like the worst of both worlds, where there's like one like form of pragmatism is like, well, I'm not going to say we need to repeal the whole war on drugs, but let's legalize pot. That's like Gary Johnson. It's more pragmatic if I just say this, because it'll be unpopular and it won't get us as far if I say the whole thing. And then there'd be like these radicals who are like, we want to abolish driver's licenses. And you're like, okay, that's radical, but it's stupid, you know?
It's
like
a spectacle. Yeah.
Right. Like this is, you're being radical on the dumbest thing to be radical on. And now you're just dismissed and you didn't even talk about anything that really matters. And so this is much more of a like, no, look, we're not giving up one inch of our principles, but we're also going to attack this thing in the most pragmatic way. And I would just say to kind of like, you know, it almost would, I would think would have to be just by the empirical evidence, undeniable that this whole vote chasing strategy is a complete failure just by the fact that we took over the party.
Correct.
Like, you know, you have Gary Johnson in 2016 gets the, what they all brag about, the highest vote totals, the highest vote. It's like, and he did. Now, you know, one of the things you've mentioned this before too, I think that I personally, I've always said this, votes mean nothing to me. They mean less than nothing to me. How many, I mean, look, I understand like maybe there's like ballot access or getting on a debate stage considerations or something like that, but just how many votes you got in a losing effort, I don't even understand why the number should mean anything.
So here's how I'll expand on that. I wouldn't say they mean nothing to me, but they're a lower order consideration. And just the way that, just the way that value is ordinal, again, you have to calculate before you act and your actions have to be arranged. So the highest value action is the thing that's going to get the most of your attention and your focus and all of that. And that's for me, local level elections and organizing this whole thing, towards maximizing that outcome. So if, you know, it's a false dichotomy, but if you were to ask me, okay, well, do you want 6 million votes, and, you know, 10, like a lower number of members to draw from to like recruit for these offices and supporting these offices, or would you want 1 million votes, but you inspire way more people who happen to be from a more narrow, demographic, we need people very badly. You know what I mean? Like, right. give me the people who are motivated to do it.
Well, and I understand what you're saying. Like you could argue that it's a false choice and say, oh, hey, I want both. Like, okay, fair enough. But you're saying if you had to choose, and that's not a made up look, Harry Brown, when he ran for president in 96 and in 2000, generated more members than Gary Johnson. He got a fraction of the votes.
He got
Gary Johnson.
4.4% of the vote in 2000. And the party had made, when adjusted for inflation, more money than it's ever made and had more members than it's ever had.
Right. So like, it's like, no, there are these scenarios where you'll have one or the other. And we're just saying what's actually more valuable. I mean, look, like there would be people who are actually arguing that Gary Johnson was the most successful presidential campaign we ever had. And then a few years later, the party was taken over by these awful, you know, right wingers or whatever they call us. And you're like, okay, well, isn't there just something like, just say that narrative 5 times in a row in your head and then find out what the like the conclusion from that is like, oh yeah, getting a big vote total actually didn't do that much. How can you brag about like, oh my God, we got this huge vote total, and then a few years later you have nothing to show for it?
Yeah. And here's the thing though, is that they're telling the truth according to how they view success. Their metric of success is completely different from yours and mine. So like, for example, there are people who are like, the Joe Jorgensen campaign was a success. And they're, one of the metrics that they might use for that is, well, you know, she had a really cheap price per vote. And if you care about votes, that's a legitimate statistic that does matter. But then what I always pointed out was, okay, she made like $3 million, a little bit more than that, spent that. And now we got what? 3,500 members came in off that. So what's the price per member?
Right.
And nobody wants to have that conversation.
yeah, exactly. And then like, you know, you kind of look at this and you go, all right, so if your big thing is, you know, chasing votes, then okay, yeah, you're going to look at it this way. But if you look at the results of the higher votes, there's nothing to show for it. So like, to me, even when someone goes, you know, when they're comparing, you know, I'd see people like arguing about different candidates. Well, this guy did better than this guy because he got more votes than him. They'll be like, yeah, but it's the same percentage of the votes. And oh, look, this guy got more votes than Shane Hazel did, so he was a better candidate than Shane Hazel was. And I'm like, no, because if you know what I mean? Like, the question is like, which one of these candidates could have actually like changed some people's mind and like won some hearts over and actually created somebody who's like going to be down with this cause for years to come? It's more difficult to measure in some ways, but that to me is really what we're here chasing. It's not just this silly idea of like, did more people vote? And I know I've heard you make this point before, but it's kind of this egocentric, removed from reality tendency of a lot of members of the LP, or at least has been in the past, that they don't even recognize that, like, I don't know exactly what percentage of the time this is, but a huge percentage of the time, the amount of votes you get has nothing to do with the candidate, has nothing to do with them even knowing
that's,
who the candidate is.
That's a really tough pill for some people to swallow. That because people, and I'm not trying to minimize, but people work their asses off for this stuff, dude.
Yeah,
and
it's, no, I know.
And it is hard, and it is thankless. And we really want to believe that, that, you know, our efforts, and maybe, you know, and I don't want to like say there's zero of it, you know, like I'm sure they earn some votes out there and all of that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
But I really think in these bigger races, because again, my metric, well, my theory is that we have to build trust, right? So the question in my mind is that why would anybody vote for us with this in-group, out-group distinction? Why would they vote for us for what they perceive to be the highest stake races when we have done nothing to earn their trust at the community level? And from their perspective, we come out of nowhere every 2 or 4 years, fuck up, quote unquote, their elections, you know, and talk about how great we are, and then disappear back into the ether only to reemerge 2 years later. I think that's kind of like what your average person who's not in our circles probably sees out of us. And so like, why would they trust us? Whereas if we come up from the community level where they perceive the political stakes to be the lowest, you know, maybe then you can get that trust. And so my point is that we have no basis to earn the trust for the highest stake races. So I think the disgust level that they have with the candidates is the highest thing, which is why, you know, I've remarked that I hope that Trump gets the nomination, not because I'm a Trump fan, but because the highest vote totals that we've ever had are running against Trump, you know, like,
Well, it's kind of impossible to know for certain. And like, it'd be really interesting if we had a time machine and you could go back to 2016 and instead of Gary Johnson, Bill Weld put on the ballot like Joe Schmo, you know what I mean? Just like name L next to him and see what the difference is and how many votes they get. And I got to tell you, I think when Donald Trump's running against Hillary Clinton and on your ballot right next to him is someone else, L, they're going to get some votes. Like, and I do think that that's like, that that's a huge factor here. And the same thing with so many of these Senate races and House races, where there's just so many people today who are disgusted by both parties that they click off the other guy's name. And in many cases, it's really no comment at all on whether that person even introduced the idea of like what we're here talking about is freedom, and that hey, there's this party, and hey, there's this this group, and hey, you can like there, you know, like there's it, like it's just it doesn't represent anything. Like in many cases, now I don't know exactly what percentage of the time that is, but it's definitely a big factor. And so I think, and this is like one of the things that I've you know been kind of talking about, and the whole project of this podcast has been for a long time, is that we kind of have to have other metrics by which we measure success. And it's not just something like, oh, who got the most votes? And of course, if you did just have this pure, this is one of the things that I was challenging the disgraced former chair on when we were in that debate, was like, okay, but if you're willing to sacrifice a little bit of principle for more votes, like maybe you could sacrifice a little bit more principle and get even more votes and a little bit more. And like, at what point are you looking at this where, why is this not worth it? And that's where the whole run Dick Cheney and get 10 million votes, which is not that crazy. Dick Cheney and George W. Bush got like 50 million votes when they were president. Maybe Dick Cheney could come to a third party and get 10 million votes, or could have at one time. Certainly not anymore, but could have at one time. And you go, so why not? And even there, I was just kind of trying to goad him into admitting that there has to be somewhere that you draw a line and go like, okay, well, if you're over that line, then we can't, you know what I mean? Like then the payoff is no longer worth it. And so you can just kind of like abducto absurdum this thing down to a point where you're like, yeah, just vote chasing is nothing. That's then you're Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or whatever.
The problem is that what we would consider to be the proper metric is a little bit harder to gauge.
Yeah.
Cause it's something like who is productively who is reaching the most people in a productive manner that alters their worldview. It's something like that. You know what I mean? Like, and that's tough. That is a tough calculate. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Although at the same time, and this is one of the things that was kind of gratifying about the whole, you know, Reno reset, is that this is kind of what we were arguing the whole time, is that we're like, no, we're doing this. While you guys are off bragging about your vote numbers and vote chasing, we are saying that we are reaching more people in a productive way that's actually altering, like that they care about something so much that they'll do this. And it was interesting to almost see that they were immune to that. Like it was almost, I remember having these, me and you talked about this, you know, in the past, and I don't want to like harp over the old battles of how we won the party over too much, but there'd be these things where like, you know, I'd be arguing on Twitter with like people in the old guard or people in the pragmatist caucus or stuff like that. And they'd be like, you Mises caucus guys are going to lose. You're going to lose every internal election. And I'd be like, we're going to take over this whole damn party. And their tweet would have like 16 likes and mine would have like 4,000 likes. Yeah. And then I'd be like, yeah, how does it look for you now? And they'd be like, whatever, man, Twitter isn't real life. It doesn't matter. Oh, yeah, you got the trolls on Twitter, but blah, blah, blah. And I always thought it was so, you know, like if anyone ever said to me, they were like, hey, we're all going to show up for this thing and we're going to vote this way. And I go, no, we're going to show up and vote this way. And my tweet had 16 likes and theirs had 4,000. I'd be like, I'm concerned. Because right. this seems to be an indication to me that a lot more people agree with that guy. And if the contest at the end of the day is who can get more people who agree with them out to this thing. And it was almost like they had a blind spot to that, that you could go back and look at some of their predictions.
Oh,
Mises caucus is going to crash and burn. You're never going to win. And then it's like they take over. We take over every inch of the party. And then they have some other excuse. Now it's, oh, you guys are going to crash and burn next year.
And they never wanted to acknowledge what the unseen part of this is, because there really is a machine here. And the machine is something like people like yourself, people like Tom, people who have the audiences, who are engaged, are essentially bringing people into the idea. And then people like me, who are more the manager or administrator layer of this thing, you know, there's like 250 state level Mises Caucus organizers that are being alerted as people come into our ecosystem. You know, and reaching out and onboarding them, and you know, then we're training them on this strategy, and then we're asking them to do calls to action, like, and it really is a machine where we feed off of each other, you know, and they just wanted to think it's just podcast bros, man, they're not really doing anything, yeah. and you know, and that's obviously not true, yeah. So
yeah, it's interesting because it just as you brought it up, I go this was kind of, even though as you're right, as you correctly say, ours is a little bit more difficult to measure, but at the same time, we kind of ran a little bit of a mini like test in which one actually produces something. You know what I mean? Like, and so that is very interesting to me to see. I also think that, like, you know, look, even without the organizational strategy, I always find it kind of interesting to be like, oh, they're just podcast bros or something. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. This is the new medium, man. Like, what do you mean? You're just right. You're just like, yeah. It's like, say, Thomas Paine. You just write pamphlets, dude. Like, oh, that's so lame. Oh, a pamphlet writer is going to tell me what to do. It's like, yeah, this is the medium of communication for today's age. That's like the most unregulated, where we actually have a chance to get our ideas out there. It's like, okay, you can scoff at that if you want to. I'm going to take it.
Here's a really good example of something that can happen when you have a good strategy and you have a good compelling call to action and you have an engaged community. And this just happened this last week. There was a major push by the guys that Bring Our Troops Home. Mm-hmm. And they had so they got Arizona to pass committee for Defend the Guard. And they did the calls and they found out that there was 7 senators that were on the swing. And this could really friggin' pass in Arizona. You know, the compelling thing there is once you get one state to do it, this is basic social psychology, is that it's the hardest thing to do is to do it first. And then it becomes possible in the minds of everybody else. They get fucking brave and it becomes safe to do it. So this is up for a vote in the Senate in Arizona. And there's only 7 senators on the swing. So like they had this huge call to action of like, we need to do calls. We need to call the shit out of them. And, you know, we answered that call. And I'm not certain, but I suspect that the Mises Caucus people and people from our list made up a majority of people who were doing the calls. And, you know, I got word from Diego and some of the guys over there that they think that there was about 1,400 calls between all of these senators made by lunch. And, you know, I made calls and I had, you know, state house staffers. Or state senator staffers being like, this is very impressive. Like we've gotten like 300 calls to this office today and this could pass. And if this passes, this is historic. This is this is a state exerting its control over foreign policy.
Yeah.
And that could legitimately happen, you know, and then all of a sudden this, politics thing isn't a joke anymore. You know, like this is very real and very meaningful and serious. You know, and we need to engage in that. But that again is why I think we have to have this kind of circle of community engagement, that then funnels into like the action.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of just sitting here and saying, oh, we're going to set the world free in our lifetime. It's like, oh, we might actually get defend the guard passed in a state. I'm like, this could really change the whole paradigm here. There's never, look, man, none of this stuff, none of the future is predetermined. It's human beings acting who are, you know, like making a difference. And we can have a real impact on this. All right, look, we're up at the end of time here. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that we didn't get to?
No, just check out the tour, takehumanactiontour.com. And if you're into the strategy, go to runaslibertarian.com. So if you go to runaslibertarian.com and you sign up, we're doing 2 online trainings a month. We've got these 6 in-person trainings, you know, the specialized trainings for sheriff. There's people who won. There's a diversity of training from Grassroots Leadership Academy, elected libertarians, the Leadership Institute. We're taking this very seriously and we're bringing the community together. So takehumanactiontour.com, get your tickets, runaslibertarian.com and, you know, buy into the strategy.
Hell yeah, man. And of course, once again, I'll be out at the giving a speech at the New York event, and great people all around. If you're anywhere near one of these cities, come on out, man. This is going to be a great time.
Yep. April 1st. That's like 2 weeks away. So, you know, get your tickets while you still can and get your lunch because you got a week left to get them before it goes out.
All right.
April 1st.
All right. Hell yeah. Dude, always great talking to you, Michael. I always enjoy our conversations and I'm real excited for everything that's coming up in the future. The future is bright for the Libertarian Party and the Mises Caucus. So thank you for coming on once again. We'll talk again soon. Thanks everybody for listening. Catch you next time. Peace.